You are now listening to the EU Startups Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the EU Startups Podcast. As always, I'm your host, David Semden Garcia, the editor at EU Startups. Today, I chat with Juana Yinga. She's the co-founder of Dexery. Some of you might know it as Bots on Us, as it was previously called. Now, Dexery is no stranger to us at EU Startups. We've been covering just about before they changed names, which was in 2022. They've raised almost 250 million euros in funding, have expanded not just across Europe, but across the US and really globally. They are a robotics and physical AI company, specifically warehouse robotics. They develop what they call the tallest autonomous robot. So we were able to chat with Juana about her own history, her own background, how she fell into Dexery, the impact of physical AI, especially when we're comparing it to the kind of more in vogue topics of AI, which is LLMs with companies such as ChatGPT, Anthropic, Claude, all these different kind of companies and LLMs, and the value of physical AI when it comes to this conversation, especially how she sees the overall sector within Europe when compared to the US, how she sees funding going around for her own sector, and even the application of gender in the sector, and if she feels that there's more space to be made for more women to join the industry, what work is left to be done. So I hope you're looking forward to that conversation. Hello, Juana, and welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on, especially because you made the time on such a short notice to come join us.
Thank you so much for having me. Now, very excited to have a chat.
Yes, yes, I am as well. During my tenure of the podcast, which has been just about a year so far now, we actually haven't had that many physical AI, even just robotics people come join us. So I am actually interested in this conversation. So the reasons why I chose you, apart from your obvious background, to come join me here. So on that note, why don't you go ahead and explain just who you are and what you do?
Sure thing. So my name is Juana Yinga, and I'm one of the co-founders at Dexery. Day-to-day, I kind of look after the commercial and product side of the business, so sales, marketing, customer success, product roadmap and strategy. But as a founder, at the end of the day, you do a bit of everything and anything and nothing at all. So very, very kind of like varied hour to hour. Maybe to touch a little bit on what Dexery does and Dexery is. So we are indeed in the physical AI space, but we are robotics and AI solution for warehousing and logistics. Which is quite a, I would say, industrial space to be in. But on the other hand, it's probably one of the biggest industries that we have as humankind. And anything and everything that is around us is, at the end of the day, something that spend time in a warehouse, at least the warehouse. Usually it's multiple of those, sometimes even 10 plus warehouses around the world. So it is definitely the industry that's connecting us all together. We have a solution that brings visibility and data and intelligence to warehouses to be able to run a lot more efficiently. And as part of that, we use some of the world's most the tallest autonomous robots, kind of a mouthful there. They go up to 18 meters in the air and scan warehouses, digitize the space, the goods, routes, kind of the people, the machinery and size, all the different kind of resources. We digitize that in real time. And then there's a lot of kind of interesting insights that we extract from that data. So yeah, we could definitely go into a lot more detail, but just to get things going.
That's a good starting point. And you're no stranger to us at EU Startups. I actually had a quick look to see over past coverage that we've done. And we go even as far back as before you were Dexery, when you were Bots on Us. You were on our radar then. And I think so far, I had a look at Crunchbase. You've raised 249 million in total funding. So that, you know, you're no slouch, that's for sure. And I do think there's a lot of good things to talk about here that will be relevant for our audience. But before we get into that, I do kind of want to touch on your background there a little bit, because that's always one of the most interesting aspects in these chats for me, is to hear about how people landed in a role that has brought them success and ability in the sector that they're in. Now, from what I read about you, I saw that you've held positions before in Telefonica, in Google. So then how does that translate into this robotics field? I know you said you're kind of on the sales and product side of things, but still you have to have some kind of understanding as to all of this to be successful in that, I imagine.
Yeah, it's a very interesting kind of story because I mean, growing up, I don't think I ever had a plan to actually get into robotics or anything like that. But I remember early days in my mind, for some reason, although I have no examples in my family, I knew that I wanted to have my own thing. Like I wanted to have my own business. And as a child, you know, I was playing around with other kids and having like your little kind of store and everything. Like it always was something kind of in the back of my mind. But I came from a very traditional family working in like medicine and have a lot of doctors in around me. So there was nothing kind of like guiding me towards it, but I always kind of had it back of my mind. So went to university, did marketing, PR, kind of management, business sales. So very, very kind of business driven. And then from there, I pretty much kind of started directly into the tech sector. So I think, as you said, I don't have a typical tech background, but I do have a lot of experience in bringing products to market, tech products to market, whether that's software or hardware. Indeed, I started at Telefonica initially on what was called like Telefonica Digital. So all the different products outside of basic telephony and text and messages and stuff like that, that telco has. It was like apps for loyalty and I don't know, all kinds of new ways of communicating internationally. This was like way back when, of course, we didn't have WhatsApp and everything else on our phones. And then I moved over to Google, where I was on the team that launched the first Google Pixel phones and the Google Home hardware that obviously like now it's very well spread. So there's always kind of been this motion in my career around finding like a cool product idea, working on it with technical teams, and then bringing it to market through marketing, sales, partnerships, and so on. And then, of course, after that, making sure that there's an after sales aspect to it. This is kind of what I do at Dexery. And to your point earlier, I was doing it Bots and Dats even when we started, because us as three co-founders, we have very kind of complementary skills, and I've always that business kind of mind in the game, like who's going to buy this, what do we want to call it, how do we take it to people.
Okay. And so what was that initial thinking with the company? Because you've been around since 2015 and now obviously AI is a huge idea and it's a huge implementation in most companies. And you even have the Dexery View, which is digital twins, right? So this wasn't really something people were talking about in 2015. So how did the business kind of gear towards that? Was that a product question? Was that something where you were seeing that most of your customers were interested in that side of the business? Or why did you kind of start adopting that from robotics?
Yeah, so it's been something that we've pretty much from day one focused on, which is using autonomous robots to collect data from the physical world. People could probably see behind me, I've got a Bots and Dats sign just up there, which is from the very, very early days. It's our first trade show that we did Bots and Dats like back in like 2016, 2017, like ages ago. And at the time, we were working on a product for the home. So we were going to use an autonomous robot to navigate your home so you could keep an eye on the house from far away. You could kind of make sure there's no, obviously, of course, kind of security issues, but also communicate with the people inside, like have this kind of view of what's happening at home from wherever you are in the world. We quickly realized that, of course, making a product for the home back then was going to be extremely expensive, like LiDAR sensors and everything else were absolutely ridiculous. So it wasn't something that people could actually afford very easily to put into the home. So we very quickly pivoted from there into the B2B space. And to your question, kind of, from the very first conversations we're having, it kind of felt people were talking to us about a very similar challenge, which was like they had an understanding of like what's happening, for instance, in their stores or in their terminals in the airport, because that was also kind of a big sector we're focusing on. But they had no way to actually track that and follow it like day after day to really understand what the reality on the ground is. So we pivoted from the home into commercial spaces. And as we were doing that, retail became a big focus for us. So with the pandemic, that was a bit of a shakeup because our market disappeared almost overnight. We were quite lucky because those retailers then started to ask us, can you actually do this inside our warehouses? Because we have a massive visibility problem. There's no way that we can track what's going on inside the warehouse. You know what goods are coming in or going out, but actually what's happening under the roof is very, very hard to monitor. And that's kind of it still means, and it was meaning back then, that they were making a lot of decisions blindly or just on kind of gut feel. So going back to where we started, it's quite like a nice loop, I would say, to where we are today. There's always been this intention of like using robots to capture reality. And now it has a word. It's called physical AI. It's called world models. Like, to your point, yeah, when we started, like, was it many years ago now, it wasn't even an idea, right? So it's great to kind of see the world catching up with it. And of course, a lot of stuff has evolved in the meantime. I was talking about the sensors that are very expensive. Now it's very, very easy and cheap to build robots. Of course, you still have to make sure that they operate day after day, and there's a lot of complexity in it. But the market has evolved so much over the past decade that we've been in it.
And how do your, what you call them, the tallest autonomous robots, right?
Yeah. Yes.
How do they kind of interact with human warehouse workers? Because you mentioned COVID, right? So that must have been a period where it must have been kind of hard to get people in the warehouse and get workers back on track and doing the jobs they were doing. So what's the interaction there? Like, can they do what a human does point blank, or is there a balance between an operator and the robot?
Yeah, so because what we do is we use these robots to scan, let's say, racks that are, like I said, all the way up to 18 meters in the air. There is an element of there's human teams that are trying to capture some of this data by doing, let's say, inventory checks or walking around and trying to spot things. But of course, they can only do a certain number of, let's say, what we call pattern locations an hour. I can only look up to about, let's say, 4 meters if you're really kind of stretching your neck, right? So what we do can't really be replicated with a human workforce unless you have a ridiculous amount of people that all they do is walk around and count boxes, which is pretty tedious and boring and also quite dangerous because you kind of have to go up and down all the way up to 18 meters all the time. So we don't necessarily kind of come in to replace something. We come in to really augment the business with a lot of real-time data and information. Hence why the digital twin that you mentioned is like where all that data gets pushed on almost instantly as it's being scanned and processed, and you kind of like open it up to a lot of insights. So it's never kind of been, from our perspective, a point like we're going to come in and automate a task. There's a very small amount of that, but there's also like a ridiculous amount of value we're bringing that, again, you can't capture with people, like taking high resolution images all around. Of course, we can't do that yet with our eyes. You never know where it's going to get to, but there's obviously like a massive amount of data that we capture with these robots. Going back to your question around like, are they interacting with people? They're actually not meant to interact with people. They're there just to collect data in the background. If anything, like the less they get in anyone's way or kind of disturb anyone, then the more successful they are, because they're just meant to be pretty much kind of capturing this information, getting out of the way of the pickers and people driving forklifts, making sure that none of their productivity is being impacted, obviously, by the robots collecting the data. So if anything, like, yeah, they're meant to not interact at all with the workforce. But of course, like most of the human colleagues of our robots are super proud to have them there, and they kind of like give them away. And there's a whole kind of human robot interaction, let's say, field that kind of happens automatically. Although the intention is like, just make sure we get out of the way and not disturb the operations.
Okay. And then, so how do these robots work practically when a customer comes to you? Is it that they're retrofitted to the warehouse that has already existed to the customer, or do you provide your own facility that includes these giant robots around it? What's
the
process?
It's extremely, extremely simple to get up and running. So we, first of all, we only put one single kind of robot per warehouse. And we actually just published the other day one of our case studies, and one of the sites that we're in is like 1.1 million square feet, I think, something. It's just like you can't even like picture how big some of these warehouses are. So even for like very, very big spaces, we only need one robot because we're scanning at a very crazy speed and capturing that in a couple of hours wall to wall. And then we can kind of go back and like get it again and again. So you're pretty much reducing to a couple of hours any kind of data gap that you have, which currently could be even months and sometimes even years until you actually figure out something is wrong. So it's just one unit, which makes it actually quite simple and easy to understand. And also, like, there is absolutely no change that needs to happen to the current warehouse that the customer has. All we need is a power plug to just get the robot in. After that, our deployment team spends about 2 to 5 days on site, depending on how complex it is, gets everything up and running, and then they start getting the data. So there's been a lot of focus that we've put from the beginning in making sure the solution can be implemented seamlessly, like super, super fast, so that we can start getting to the value as quickly as possible with our customers.
Okay. And would that be the most difficult part of the kind of journey that the company has had, has been figuring out this customer application? Because you're already at your Series C, I think, if I have my notes right. So obviously you figured out your market, you figure out your product. But throughout that journey, there had to be a growing pain, I imagine, in getting it to work. Was it figuring out the actual application of the robot? Was it convincing people that they should have a giant robot in their facility? What was that kind of process for you?
Yeah, it was everything, right? So when we, because we rebranded to Dexory and introduced this particular product just about over 3 years ago. It was like in 2023. So it's still relatively new if you think about the logistics sector, which obviously like it's a massive market, but still a little bit more traditional. And of course, once you make some changes, the implications can be huge in terms of like if that doesn't go well, customers get upset, transportations get messed up. There's like a whole kind of implication to it. So I think, yeah, without kind of singing our praises, we managed to do so much in 3 years because of that solution being as seamless as I said earlier. So I think it was a combination of, yeah, in the beginning, coming out of Europe, even a small kind of company in the UK, trying to actually create a brand within the sector, it's a very kind of big endeavor because you were relying on these massive customers, and you kind of see a lot of the names on our website, like your DHL and Maersk. And I did just some of the biggest kind of like logistics companies in the world, getting their trust to allow you in their sites and doing such an important part of the work. Obviously, that takes a bit of time. So that was kind of number one is, first of all, this is who we are. Yep, the solution works. Trust us on this and start to kind of build that in. And with the first kind of case studies, then that starts to get a snowball effect and people find out about you in the market and so on. But then on the technical side, of course, there were a number of things that you had to figure out. So one is when it comes to the robots themselves, like you have to make sure the data is extremely correct, because as with any kind of AI product, at the end of the day, what we're offering is data. It's not the robots themselves. They're just there to collect that information. What we do with the information is what's important. So if that information is wrong, your insight and what you're offering on the other side is going to be wrong. So there's a whole element of making sure that the robots obviously are super accurate. And when you're talking about these massive spaces, that you're still at like centimeter accuracy, even after navigating 1 million square feet, which anyone working robotics knows how difficult that is. But then thirdly, like there's a whole element of making sure, like I said earlier, that data that we provide brings value. And we started with simple use cases. Then we observed how the customers are using that data to extract all kinds of like additional bits of information. So I'll give an example. Like when we initially started, we were looking at stock accuracy. So we're comparing what the robot was scanning to what customers had in the different systems that they were using in the warehouse, pointing any discrepancies, quickly kind of telling them you can action these kind of 5 locations right now to fix stuff. But very, very quickly, we moved on from that because we observed people were using the pictures we were taking to find ways in which they, for example, kind of create more space by bringing different bits of stock together, how they're trying to reduce walking distances by bringing products together, how they're trying to reduce congestion. There's so many kind of different ways of optimizing the site that this data was now allowing them to do, which wasn't like a possibility before because it just didn't have access to that information. So that then kind of quickly came into the product. And very recently, we launched what we call Dexory Review Adapt, which is our full kind of play on agentic, which is really kind of now being a lot more proactive and forward thinking for seeing a problem might arise further down because we can see what goods are coming into the site or what promotions are happening. We're helping them stay on top of that even before that kind of hits their supply chain. So I think going back to your question is like one thing is, of course, getting in the market as a startup, it's always like very, very hard, especially when you're going industrial, having a reliable kind of data source. But thirdly is always adapting the product and keep building on it to bring more and more value to our customers.
Okay. Well, on this topic then that you're talking about kind of entering a market initially as a startup, as we mentioned before, that was back in 2015, right? And we're talking over just more than a decade now. So you've obviously had some time in to see competitors, to see the ecosystem, to see peers and how they evolve. So with that in mind, I had a look over our past coverage of kind of the physical AI warehouse robotics space. And that's just for this year that I had a quick look at. And from what I've seen, this is just a quick look, there's $244 million in funding. that kind of just circled around the same area that Dexter is working in. So with that in mind, how do you see that space within Europe? Is it growing in a correct way, do you feel, from 2015 to now? And how does that compare when we're looking at international markets, when we look at the U.S., which you have expanded to, and that's another point of the conversation. But what do you see the European sector looking like right now?
I was going to say, is that million or billion? Because
well, from what we've covered, and I just want to put that out there, we don't cover everything as much as we'd like to.
Yeah.
Just from 2026, from companies that we've seen, that's the million is what I saw. But because, I'm sure it can be very much higher, yes.
Yeah, because I always kind of like, I talk a lot about physical AI because like obviously it's our bread and butter and it's been for a very long time. It's a very interesting space because you can break it down into a lot of different subsectors. And then your point is exactly like, okay, how much funding is going in it across everything or specifically in the robotic side of it? Because there is a whole element of, everyone's kind of comparing physical to digital AI, which of course in digital AI and especially LLMs, because that's the one thing a lot of people understand now with ChatGPT and Claude and everything else, is like you have the whole internet, let's say, to kind of train language models on so that they become better and better. And when you're interacting with them, when you move into the physical world, the number one point is like you need physical data so that you can train other physical agents like robots so that they know how to react to physical realities. And if you kind of think about physical AI as the whole thing, like you have to include perception systems that understand the world and the models of that world and the way that those are being stored and processed and like then spread out to fleet. So there's a massive kind of sector there, which is why I was asking, like, actually, if you put everything together, you're talking about a couple hundred billion at kind of global level. If you then look at only at the robots and only at the robots in warehouses, then that obviously like kind of gets smaller and smaller. And I feel like automation in the warehousing space is nothing new. It's like it's been around for ages. But what the robots can do now and then how much better they are and how they react to all the flexibility requirements of kind of different spaces, I think that's the interesting side of things. And it is a very hot topic. And actually, I feel Europe is doing really well. I mean, I'm super proud for us to be part of a great community. And I think we cover so many different use cases across I'll say the European ecosystem, from like moving things to like scanning things to humanoids as well. Like we have some fantastic humanoid stories here as well. And it's only going to get better and better. The number one thing I would say that I'm seeing less of is actually, if you kind of like open up the books and where some of the big rounds are coming from, it's actually not European investors investing in the European companies. It's like investments from Asia, of course, the US, but like Middle East, especially, that just there's kind of a lot of money from Middle East coming into the European side of things. So I would always kind of urge European investors to really be a lot bolder when it comes to full stack companies, because I mean, 10 years ago when we started, of course, everyone was running the other way when you're talking about supply chains, physical production, all of that stuff. People are like, oh my God, that's very capital intensive. We don't want to get anywhere near it. Now it's a very hot topic, but still people are like, ugh, but the unit economics should be a little bit better. Like, you know, finances should be a bit better. Like, well, you have to invest in this physical stuff to get it out there. Otherwise, you're not going to have, you could do as much digital AI as you want, but if no one's going to put it in practice, obviously that's going to be a bottleneck forever. So I think to go back to your question, the number one thing that needs to happen, I feel, is that European investors just need to be bolder and take bigger bets earlier in the stages of these companies.
You know, I find this question always interesting because it's always different depending on if I'm asking a founder or if I'm asking an investor. And you guys kind of pass the buck from one to the other. You know, it's always on the other one that it's not working out. But I think things are going the right way. And as you said,
100%.
I think they are going the right way. Is there space to improve? Of course, there is. It's always interesting to me to see that kind of difference in narrative between the founders and the investors. But it's a symbiotic relationship, and it seems to be moving in the right space. Then kind of speak on this whole Europe angle of things. As I mentioned briefly, that you have expanded to the U.S. I think last I saw there was some opening in Nashville. Just from something I saw there. So what's that been like as a European company moving into the U.S.? Has it been an easier process? Because we hear so much about how the U.S. is so easy and regulation holds Europe back and there's so much money in the U.S. So Has it been a more easy, less friction process for Dexory?
I mean, first of all, we've been kind of global from day one, I would say, because working in logistics and supply chain, our customers are global. So from the beginning, we knew that we had to be able to operate anywhere. So it goes back to your question earlier, like the reason it's so easy to deploy and install and ship and everything else is because we knew that we had to be able to operate everywhere. So we're actually live across about 17 different markets. And we had our first US deployments with actually European customers that took us to their US sites. I think it was early 2024. So way before we even had an office or physical presence in the US itself. And I always kind of tell people, there's no longer this need, like you have to kind of start from scratch in a market, build a local team, push the marketing. Like obviously the whole world is global now. And especially when it comes to logistics, like just let your customers take you into a new market, see how that's going, and then start kind of building locally. So that's what we did for North America. And we did open our Nashville HQ in March. It was like a really cool event. Like we had so many people coming over, a lot of existing customers, new prospects as well. I think it was the right time to do it because now we have a significant presence there when it comes to customer base. We have a very big team across the whole kind of country. But also from there, we're serving Canada and Mexico, which are very important markets as well. So I would say the advice I normally give people is like you don't have to think about it as a bottoms up, slowly invest a lot of money to do your marketing and everything else. It's like try and find customers that could take you with them into the market and then start building around that.
Okay. So then what's next? Because you've been around for over 10 years now. You're a Series C. You've been global since day one, as you say. You found your product, you found your market. What comes next for a company like you? Is an IPO of an interest to the founding team, or do you prefer being a private company?
Yeah, and first of all, just wanted to kind of clarify, between 2015 when we incorporated and like 2020 when we started to look at logistics, it was a very kind of slow bootstrap process. Obviously, we did have some solutions for retail. They were going well. That was growing. We had some European Union funding, which was fantastic at the time because it kind of helped us build a team and get stuff off the ground. But it didn't really start going properly into the right direction until we launched the logistics solution, which was 2023. So it's one of those typical kind of overnight success that took a decade. but it was specifically when we launched the brand Dexory and this product, like I said, we're kind of 3 and a bit years ago, that we started to get the funding in because we found that product market fit and everything else. So you might be working on an idea for a long time. Then you find that nugget of like, actually, if we turn it into this, it might create a business. So you could argue like, are you looking a decade back? Which 100%, like all that experience from the beginning helped us build what Dexory is today. But from everyone else's view, Dexory is only about 3.5 years old. So yeah, it's always like what's under the, what's the bottom of the iceberg, right? But what's coming next? I mean, we have some pretty ambitious kind of goals for the end of this year. Of course, the team's growing quite a lot. But the most important thing is all the stuff I was saying earlier, like what else we can do with the data. We are sitting on the data, the biggest kind of database of warehouses, like or warehouse operations, let's say. Like we have over 1.6, 1.7 billion locations scanned so far, quite a few hundred sites that we're capturing day after day after day. So that allows us to really understand how warehouses operate and really build those warehouse models that, going back to my point earlier, no one else has access to. So we're looking at what else can we extract from this to help our customers like connect the dots between different facilities, different markets that they have, but also working with quite a lot of other robotics players in the field to see how that data can help them become better and better. Because again, having a whole machine that captures this, it's big, expensive, it's complicated. And some of the others in the field don't necessarily have to do that because we already have the infrastructure for them. So we're looking at how we can orchestrate more and more of that automation in the space by using our data.
How does that play into? Because I read in just my research, I don't remember quite, but it popped out to me, was that that you had a focus on ethics in robotics and unbiased AI. So how does this kind of the goal of the company play into that? How does it even play into what you do concretely?
Yeah, there's a lot of different elements to it. So first of all, I mean, if you kind of break it down into the bias side of things, I mean, if you train an AI with data sets that are very, very similar from very similar environments, of course, like you're going to have certain results that are going to be quite repetitive based on obviously what data you've given them. So when it comes to, very practically speaking, the customer base that we have, we are working across very different types of customers because we intentionally wanted to do that from the beginning. We got retailers, we got pharma companies, we have automotive players, we have like pet food. Like it's just, and to the point earlier as well, some facilities are 1 million square feet. Some are like just a couple, like 20, 30,000 square feet. So we're trying to capture as much different type of data and diversified environments and different types of goods and geographies so that you have this kind of very strong database that can then obviously kind of train models to be able to understand based, okay, where am I now? I have all this kind of like previous information, so I know how to react to it. So there's kind of an element of that bias there. When it comes to the ethical side and the diverse side as well, is like when it comes to our team, we make sure that we have, first of all, very international team, very diverse team from the perspective of the engineers that we have working in, but also at the leadership level. So that, again, based on our user base, which is a global user base, the way we build our products, keep that in mind. And then the way we test things as well, kind of uses the team across the board. So going back to where the customers are, we make sure that we do our best to think a little bit like the way they might think or the way that they might use the products. So there's a lot of kind of focus that we're putting on that. And also when it comes to the other side of ethics, which is the regulation side that you're talking about earlier, trying to get involved in those conversations and be there and be top of mind for regulators, not just to kind of push back on them, but also to make sure that if they're building certain frameworks, that they're built based on the reality on the ground. Like, again, we see so many different kind of sites across different markets. I know there's a lot of work happening here in the UK, for instance, at the moment on robotics. And we try to advise a lot, like, this is what people are telling us on the ground. This is exactly what we're seeing, rather than, in theory, it should be like this. Well, like, just let's make sure that we have that practical element in it. So, we try and get involved in those conversations.
Yeah, I saw something. You were in Downing Street, weren't you? For something. Yeah. What was that on? Is this the same idea here of getting involved with regulation talks?
Yeah, I mean that particular one, and like we've been a few times, which is kind of great to have the privilege of obviously kind of here getting your voice out there and becoming an expert in your field, right? But I think that particular one was more focused on talent, and again we are struggling with talent in our field, so trying to figure out how can we attract more people into the robotic space and into companies like ours, because I feel like there's a lot of shiny things out there, especially when it comes to all the big AI companies that are obviously kind of paying the big bucks, and a lot of the great talent is going that way. So we're trying to figure out how to make sure that we stay relevant in the space.
I think actually that leads naturally to the last topic that I want to touch on before we wrap this up. And it was the because you've talked about diversity, you've talked about talent, and I think that kind of leads us into a gender question as well, which I think is important. Just if you look at our own catalog, we've been trying really hard to get more kind of female voices involved with us and highlight female founders and hopefully bring more attention that they do exist. And, you know, it's not some unicorn in the wild. It's actually quite common, but there's still work to do. And the reason why it even prompted us was because we had a look at our catalog and we realized 95% of this is men. Maybe we should be making more of an effort here to highlight other kinds of voices. So then on your end, what's that ecosystem looking like? Do you feel it's a fairly gender neutral workplace and work balance when it comes to robotics and physical AI, or is there still kind of work to be doing on that front?
Yeah, it's a great question because I feel our sector is actually probably a lot more diverse than people realize. And even if I look at our own teams, like we have a lot of women working in very, very different type of roles. And I feel maybe robotics is a bit of a bad reputation because people just think about you have to be a hardware engineer, have to be a software engineer, have to kind of like have grown up with a screwdriver in your hand and a certain kind of type of profile. But actually, robotics is a business at the end of the day, which has to have a lot of the different functions of a business. So you don't necessarily have to be an engineer to work in robotics. You can definitely work on commercial side of things, like I'm saying, on customer success. And so there's so many kind of different angles to it. But even when it comes to the engineering roles, like people focus too much on the product you're building and not as much on the end customer and the problem you're solving with that particular product. So if I'm looking at the logistics sector, it's actually a very diverse sector. We have so many female users across the different types of teams that we're interacting with. So I think people just keep driving with the tech when they're talking about robotics rather than actually talking about the benefits and the use cases, which I feel would attract a lot more kind of female talent to the field, because you're actually realizing, well, these are problems that I understand that I can get exposed to and actually kind of bring a lot of value to. So I think there's a big kind of element there. And then I was talking about this the other day as well, around like, we just need to change a little bit the topics that we're bringing forward. And of course, the examples, like you said as well, of women in the field, and make sure that like we don't just focus on the technical side of things, actually on the whole, like actually building a business around it. But I think things are going in the right direction. And even today, I think I saw on LinkedIn a post about how many billionaires have been created by AI. There are women, which is great to see. It's probably like one of the what you want to call a sector or an industry, whatever you want to call it, or capability that has created the biggest number of female billionaires. That's what the article was saying. I think that kind of shows, again, that maybe with AI, taking away that bias around like you have to be highly, highly technical and have kind of studied and have a PhD in computer science, you can actually build so much more with those tools and focus, again, on what problem you're solving, which is a fundamental human problem rather than a gender-specific one.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think that puts a nice little bow over our chat here. I think we've covered a lot of kind of your whole history here, but also a lot of interesting looking forward to the future and your opinions on physical AI and robotics and all that, which I think is, it's pretty unique, I think, so far in terms of conversations I've had on here. So I want to thank you for that very much, Juana, and for joining me here today.
Thank you so much. Lovely to chat.
Okay, we'll keep in touch then.